Welcome back to the Pagan Dawn podcast. For today's episode, we are going to be talking to Aaron Oberon, the writer of Southern Cunning, Folkloric Witchcraft in the American South. So, Aaron, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. So my name is Aaron Oberon. I'm a witch, an author, an artist. I've been practicing witchcraft since I was 13, for all the seriousness that a 13-year-old can practice witchcraft at. I grew up in a really small Florida town, very conservative, very Southern. And I didn't have a whole lot of resources when I had this, I'm special, I want to be a witch. I had TV, and I had a little book in my Southern Baptist church library that was all about the dangers and evils of Wicca. And I was so fascinated by this book. And the purpose of this book is to tell you how Wicca is Satan's playground, right? And its purpose is to lure you into a false sense of security with these false earth religions. And it was really supposed to scare me. And I was obsessed. I thought this thing called Wicca was the coolest thing ever. And I was really, really fascinated. But that was all I had, was that and TV. So I started kind of piecemealing together what felt like witchcraft to me, which was getting an old leather-bound book that had all these archaic phrases that sounded so melodic and spell-like, and using that in my daily life to create changes around me. And that little melodic archaic book was the Bible, New and Old Testament. That became my first and still oldest running spell book. I use the Psalms in my daily life now as an adult, the same way I did as a child. Psalm 98 for protection. I think it was Psalm 78 for money. Anything that I needed, I got out of that Bible. I had my first altar, was basically a Christian altar. My mom just thought I was feng shuiing, was how she put it. I had my prayer card. I know. She wasn't scared of what I was doing, because it was all under this very earnest veneer of Christianity. I loved Jesus. But I also, we did have AOL internet, dial-up internet, so I could every once in a while sneak some online sources. And the first thing that I could Google was, does Christian Wicca exist? It was the first thing I looked up, because I was very earnestly born again Southern Baptist. I was washed in the blood of Christ, all that good stuff, or bad stuff because of internalized religious trauma as a young queer person growing up in the Southern Baptist church. And there were a couple websites about Christian Wicca. And of course, you know, 13 years old, don't exactly have a lot of like discernment skills and research. And I have maybe 20 minutes between the time I'm home and my mom comes home and calls me a Satanist. So I had to be quick about it. You know, I had to clear the search history and use what little bits I would snag to try and create some kind of a practice. And it was really this honest, authentic melding of pop culture representation of witches, my idea of what being a witch was, some early internet Wicca websites, and at its core was Christianity. That's what I did for a long time. Come high school, I met people who actually strongly identified as, no, I'm Wiccan. I met people who had actually been raised Wiccan. I met their parents and got a lot of these, not so much from the parents, but from the kids, the, oh, what do you mean you use the Bible? You can't do that. That's not magic. I was like, well, what the hell do I know? They must be right. So I put all that stuff to the side and I tried to be a good witch. Really found that while Wiccan techniques worked, it just didn't resonate the same as this kind of Christian amalgamation of things that I was doing before. And I kind of just went through the motions, casting the quarters, finding patrons, all the stuff that you're supposed to do. And it was okay. It just wasn't the same. So going off to college, I now, for the first time in my life, this little small town boy who's always been under the church and parents' thumbs, I'm finally free to research whatever I want and really do whatever felt right. You know, I not only came out as gay, but I came out as non-binary for the first time, as queer. I really started understanding things like cultural appropriation, which had been huge in what I was doing before, because again, limited resources, you read something as a teenager in a book and you just think it's the truth. So really started educating myself, doing a lot of anti-racist work, doing a lot of kind of self-actualization, doing a lot of personal research on my own background and history, and found out that that whole spiel about, oh, the Bible and magic just doesn't mix. Oh, it turns out some of the oldest magical traditions in the world go to the Bible. Turns out that folk magic and Christianity have been hand in hand for as long as Christianity has been a colonial colonizer religion. And every single culture that's been consumed by Christianity has then taken the Bible and said, oh, we're going to use this now. And that I was kind of following in the footsteps of my ancestors by doing something that felt really natural, by hiding my interest and love of witchcraft in the Bible. And I don't even like the word hiding because it makes it seem like I don't appreciate some of that Christianity.
No, it's more like using.
Using, yeah.
Using it all together. But yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
it's just a fascinating mixture, honestly, of everything.
Thank yeah. you. And it was about that time that I started looking again around at the world around me. And like, I've identified as a pagan for a long time, but my paganism and my witchcraft never melded as easily as I had seen it for my peers. A lot of people, especially my Wiccan peers, it was like hand in hand. There was never any friction between those two. And there was for me. And I couldn't really quite grasp why for a long time. Like, why is there such an issue for me? And I started going to traditional witchcraft. You know, Jim and Gary, who is just a blessing, had recently put out their Cornish Book of Ways, and that had hit the markets. I was still a poor college student, so didn't really have that at my disposal. But I did have people who were like, oh yeah, there is this thing called traditional witchcraft. And I was like, that's so close. I feel this resonating so much more, but there was still a bit missing. And I really used all those resources I had in college to my best advantage. And I started looking into folklore. And again, I always like to cite my inspirations. Sarah Ann Lawless, Corey Hutcherson and Lane from New World Witchery, Betwixt and Between, the Betwixt and Between podcast. They were all talking at the same time about fairy tales and folklore and how does that influence? And it really just kind of stirred this thing in me of why not just be inspired? Why not go through and look through collections of these things and just see if it works as magic? And you know what? It does. And so towards the end of college and when I started moving out on my own, graduating, mind you, my degree is nowhere related to witchcraft. I just did all of this in my free time because I wanted a career that would pay the bills, not just something that I
We all do. We certainly yeah. all do.
Got that good old psych degree. And so I, you know, kind of went off into the world. moved to kind of a semi-rural area again and had a weird period of time where it was just kind of me out in the middle of nowhere with just abandoned crossroads and a lot of coyotes and a job where I worked 16 hours a day and got home in the middle of the night. And I remember this really specific moment when I had been already started this process of kind of going through collections of folklore and seeing, like, does this work? Is this something that I can make into a practice for me? Something that works, something that resonates. And I went down to the crossroads and I had a bottle of beer with me, poured a little bit out at each direction, and had this moment of all those night creatures just chirping and buzzing, stopping. And I'm standing there and I feel the presence of someone who I identify as the witch father in the book. And that's such a, I use that as a really catch-all term because the name that I use for them is so personal, but I feel the devil there. And I just say, you know, I want to know, is this something that needs to be out in the world? Is this viable? Is this something that not only I need, is this something that other people need? And stood there in the crossroads for a while. And after I finished my beer, gave the rest of my beer to him, turned around, and I don't know if you guys have ever done this, but blowing into the top of an empty beer bottle to kind of
make
Yes.
Yeah. So,
that's something that I've always done for my spirits, and I'm not a very musically minded person, so I just turn around and like any good witch, I never look back. And I'm just kind of blowing this tune and looking up, and I see a shooting star. And I then see another shooting star. And another. And I say, okay. Yeah, this is what's happening. And from then on, I took this journal that had all of this collection of notes, this kind of chicken scratch, this worked, this didn't work, no results, high resolution, like high resonation. And I started kind of piecing it together into something that was more readable. And that's what ended up becoming Southern Cunning. And
yeah, this is the point in the book that I can see that you don't see the witch as something like a fluffy bunny. Just this is the thing that I like the most, because a lot of the things are like, yes, it's all light and roses and crystals and everything fine and nice. And I got this book and I was in love, really. So I wanted to ask you, what is the witch about? Like, how do you imagine the witch and the Southern witch? Because I saw a difference between the books that I used to read normally, and then your book.
Well, thank you for the love. I really appreciate that. I see the witch as a wild thing. And this comes from, again, kind of my personal background of, like, you have to hide or you're in trouble. And this is, for me, where a lot of queerness meets witchcraft, right? There was so much. I'm recording in a closet right now, which feels very thematic because in every single way, I was closeted. I had to hide everything. So there, this undercurrent of secrecy was immediately so important to my witchcraft because it's a survival thing. We were also not very monetarily substantial. Like, I try not to say poor anymore, because I think I think I'm way more privileged than that, actually, on reflection. But it was a rough time. Single parent, three kids, living in a broken down house with a roach infestation. And using magic was part of how I kind of helped us move along, I think, still to this day. And my mom using magic and not realizing that she's doing magic. That woman, she was a prophetess. she would have the most vivid prophetic dreams and be able to make smart business decisions because of them. You know, so we, of course, that's not magic. That's not magic.
No. Yeah, you know, it's always the way, especially when you're brought up Christian. Oh, yeah. Yes.
And, you know, Joseph had prophetic dreams, so it's not bad. So, but there still was this kind of undercurrent of secrecy. And then when you read through these tales of witches, not just your pop culture witches, which I still love. Hey, I love me a Hocus Pocus. I love me a Charmed.
Practical Magic.
Oh, yeah, I'm watching Sabrina on Netflix.
I love all of those things. And they're great. And they did influence me. But what really has shaped what I see as the Witch Day are these old folk tales. Witches are always this kind of really on the sidelines, really at the edge of a community. They sometimes help the community. Oftentimes, they are the most feared person in the community. Sometimes they're incredibly dangerous. Sometimes they're spiteful and petty. But yeah. At the core, they're...
It's what I would call a proper Granny Weatherwax.
Yeah.
Terry Pratchett. You know, there, Granny Weatherwax. That is a witch.
There you go. And, and to me, a witch, if we're going to look at the South, if we're going to look at folklore, and I don't think this is exclusive to the South, but I do think it's a defining characteristic. A witch always pays her dues. A witch always gets what's hers, or theirs, or his, and is just a little to the side of wild and othered. So I don't think that a witch always has to be cursing every single person that cuts them off in traffic, but I do think that if the idea of cursing or selfish magic or malefic magic is just so outside. Like if it's something that genuinely scares you, then why take the term witch? Because those two things are so intertwined. For thousands of years, that's what a witch is. That's why you're a witch and not a folk magician or a cunning man or a community healer, because the witch has this wild side. Has this dangerous side, because and this is a very personal definition for me, but the craft comes from the land, wherever that land is. And the land, everyone has this kind of idyllic Elysian field idea about the land. It loves you. No, it doesn't. It doesn't care.
Yes. Yeah. You know, you have to take the good with the bad.
No, it doesn't. I realized going back to because I moved to another city, and I actually realized that at some point the city I was born in hated me because I could never reach it with the airplane. It was so ridiculous. I went four times and I had to go with the airplane in another city, and I just knew that it doesn't want me there anymore. It's not, everything is not like yay. No, not at all. It was very difficult for me to get to the city I was born.
Yeah, I suppose I have a question. So, you know, you're having lived in two places that are so different. Would you say then that your witchcraft or your witch practice is different depending on the place where you are?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. One, the spirits are different. So if you're someone who works with kind of like gods, who are these, depending on your tradition, might be omnipresent, maybe your practice doesn't change a lot from place to place. I'm practicing from the land, even at a young age. And so the spirits are intimately different. In Maryland, as a child, I had a lot more success connecting with land spirits. Because I was just allowed to be out a lot more. I had a lot more freedom. My parents weren't concerned about my safety as much. And don't get me wrong, there are still dangerous things. Like, stags are still, like, super territorial and can kill a person. They're still dangerous. Yeah. But we just weren't worried about that stuff up there. So, connecting with the land was a lot easier. Things like omens changed immediately. So while I'm in Maryland, which is a place that experiences the four traditional seasons, spring, summer, winter, fall, there they have things like lightning bugs, or fireflies. I don't know what the scientific name is. And we would catch them in jars. And, you know, I, at a young age, had a form of kind of omen taking myself. I remember one time walking with one of my step parents and just saying, "Oh, there's a storm coming." And my stepmom goes, "Why do you say that?" And I was like, "Oh, look at the way the fireflies are flashing. They're going crazy. There's going to be a storm." And I didn't, it was just an instinct as a little kid, you know, as a young child, you're just like so confident about everything and you're so sure. And lo and behold, I was right. There was a storm brewing. We had a tornado sit down that night. So you absolutely have these differences. Now as an adult, where I live in Florida still, and I spend a lot of time out in whatever natural spaces that I can find. And I don't like to, or I don't want to, I should say, make it sound like you have to go into quote unquote natural spaces to practice craft. Like, I'm very urban as well. I have a strong relationship with the spirit of my apartment building and all that good stuff. But there is something in this kind of Western ideology that I'm indoctrinated with about getting into those natural spaces. Going down to the Everglades, which isn't that far from me, is almost like a pilgrimage, because it recharges everything about me. And I'm not necessarily going down there and like, all right, let's open everything up. Let's listen for all the signs from spirit. And it's more just like, no, let's be here and be in this moment. Let's see where, you know, I've been to the very tip of the state where the Everglades flow down into the Florida Bay and meet the water, where the mangroves are reaching out and you can see the fog across the water, and where our very rare population of crocodiles could be hiding in the murk. And just being there in that moment allows you just a special kind of beauty that you're not going to experience anywhere else.
Do you think then, having practiced both in the countryside and in the city, I live in the countryside in England, do you think people that are practicing witches in big cities like Florida or here, like in London, do you think they have to make more of an effort to be able to practice their craft?
Only in so much as we have been indoctrinated by the witchcraft community and the culture of modern day witchcraft that magic happens in these quote unquote natural spaces. I don't think you need to try any harder other than to get rid of our own indoctrination. There is so much magic in your apartment complex. There's so much magic in your city streets. I have, my crossroads now is an intersection with incredibly busy traffic and traffic lights. But guess what? The old man can still hear me when I go down there and I leave him a beer.
Well, this old man you're speaking about, I guess he can hear you wherever you go.
That's true. Anywhere that's in between. Anywhere that's between those crevices. No, I absolutely think it's going to be different, right? I'm speaking with a friend who does pretty much exclusively his craft in the city. I'm kind of in and out, right? I have... Florida's a weird place where we have like the heart of a city and then, oh yeah, here's a 7 mile long strip of swamp that just crosses the city. Here is a mangrove forest that started growing 3 years ago and now has overtaken this entire suburb and now is a designated, protected natural space. So I have this kind of privilege of being able to do work in the city and work in these natural spaces. But I have a friend who practices exclusively in a city, and he makes relationships with the old oak trees around him. He makes relationships with the buildings and their age and the spirits there, the house spirits. Your house spirit should be one of the most, regardless of where you live, that should be one of the most important spirits in your practice, because hello, you want to be comfortable in your house, make them happy. You know, so
yeah, that's true. I got a nest of ladybugs the moment that I started working. I had a huge nest of ladybugs. The apartment was just full of ladybugs. It was very weird. And I live in the city, like in the middle of the city.
That's good for your plants, though.
Yes, it is very good.
I'm not very good with plans, though. I have to admit that.
I've had some struggles as well. I have a very strong relationship with Brugmansia, Angel Trumpets, and Ladybugs. I had to go out and get like a box of 1,000 ladybugs to try and save them from mealies, the mealybugs, the little white things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, RIP, unfortunately, they weren't able to make it.
No.
Well, since you mentioned the Witch Father again, I'm too curious. I just need you to speak a little bit more about it.
Sure. It's such a, you know, in traditional witchcraft, there's kind of been this thing that's sometimes it's a little too serious, sometimes it's a little tongue in cheek, but the mysteries, right? It's always been this idea of like, oh, you just don't understand unless you experience it. And I always thought that was a little, what's the word I'm looking for? Like looking down on others. And then I experienced a mystery and I was like, oh, no, it really is just, you have to experience it to understand.
Yeah. Oh, well, the craft is experiential after all. You know, you can write books and tell people and talk and talk, but you have to go out there and practice. And it's not until you start practicing when you really feel the difference. It's about feeling it in your heart and inside you. And that's why we're not really being condescending. We're not really looking down on people. We're just asking them, just go out there and practice.
Exactly. And I think the problem was, and that was the word I was looking for, was condescending. Sometimes, but sometimes people are a little condescending in the community. And it's just something to be aware of. But when I first started having, again, going through what I now refer to as folkloric witchcraft, this thing that's rooted in storytelling, that's rooted in land and ancestral practices, that's when I started experiencing these mysteries. And so the witch maker, the witch initiator, witch mother, witch father, these figures are so hard to describe because there's so many. My personal relationship, and the entity that I primarily work with, it is a very masculine presence, and so he feels very correct. Father feels very correct, witch father. But it's not a hand-holdy relationship. It's not a, I'm guiding you on the right path. It's a, you asked for this. Hope you're ready.
You should have asked properly if you didn't get what you wanted.
You know? And really, this is a presence that I associate more with when I lived up north. So in America, Maryland is where I lived. And again, it's this weird place where people are like, oh, that's not the South, or that's not this. And to them, I say, eat it. I was raised Southern. It's part of my culture. I don't care where I lived. And if you haven't been there and you haven't been in the household, probably don't want to judge someone else's cultural references and upbringing. So this figure who I identify as the Witch Father, primarily the relationship began up there, but was so strong. And I think that old saying of like the gods protect children and fools is really, really true. Because I was a dumb kid. I'm not gonna sugarcoat it and sit here and be like, oh no, I was sure, like book smart? Yeah, totally. I did okay. I was all right in school, but in terms of like, hello, Eldridge God, who comes to me in the shape of a malformed stag, please enter my life and be here forever at 14. I think they went easy on me. I really do. I'm not going to say they're going to do that for everyone.
I think that this is a typical thing that you do as a 14-year-old witch. I have to be honest. It's like everything you see is like, oh, nice, something happened. Just come inside my life and let's have fun.
It's very that. And it could be super dangerous. And I think for a lot of people, it could be. You hear those horror stories and all the ghost hunter shows of my daughter dabbled in the Wiccas and then we got haunted or whatever. And I'm not saying that those are or aren't true, but I am saying the entity that I made contact with as an early teenager definitely was like, kid, I don't think you know what you're doing. And
so, he probably really liked you. He was like, oh, he's so sweet.
And so I've felt this presence. And, you know, names are such a weird thing because, again, at the time, what resources did I have? Resources saying, the devil's not in the craft. Thank you, practical magic. Or the Celtic gods are the gods of witchcraft. Thank you, every Wicca book written in the late 1990s. And so, like, I didn't have a name other than what I could find piecemeal together. So I started calling this entity Kernonos. And the entity responded. But as I got older, I was like, this doesn't make sense. You know, when I finally learned that Kernonos is not this antlered god of Wicca, but is instead a Gaulish god mostly associated with, like, markets and making money and having high status. I was like, okay, so this doesn't make sense. So it took a lot of kind of visionary trance work and mediumship to speak with this entity and be like, hey, I've been calling you Kernonos for like, oh, I don't know, 10 years. Is that your name? And just getting this kind of firm, no, that's not my name.
But I came anyway.
Yeah.
I knew you were calling me anyways.
And I think there's something to that. I think names have power. I think names are incredibly powerful. But I also think, and here's where that huge debate comes in, right? Intent versus practice. But I think this particular entity knew that I was calling to what I was feeling, which was, you know, I come from a family of hunters. I see deer everywhere I am. I'm like, I see this antlered entity, which makes sense why I would think it's Kernonos, right? At that age. And so, sure, I'm using the wrong name, but they saw me and saw what I was calling for and saw the intent, that dirty word intent, and they answered. And I think there is a period of time where they were like, you don't know what you're asking for. And sometimes I'm going to give it to you and you're not actually going to like what happens. And sometimes it's going to work out. And that's life. And then flash forward to the last 10 years of my practice, when I started really getting more of an understanding, you know, early 20s, understanding more things, doing more research. And I started talking to him and again, these trance states, doing divination, kind of asking the right questions for the first time, you know, saying, are you the devil? Are you Satan? He was like, not really. That's a different guy. He does good stuff. Good work on that one, but not really quite the same as me. I was like, okay. And again, living in Florida now, are you a spirit tied to Florida? Oh, no, not at all. Okay. Are you tied to where I used to live? And he was, yeah, absolutely. You've been calling me since you're 10 years old. I'll answer you. We have something going on here. So understanding who the Witch Father was an ongoing process for almost 20 years of trying to figure out. And again, that's that mystery of the name matters. And I have a name now that I use privately. And I have a name that I do use publicly. And I talk about the book, The Black Woodsman, because this is a name that comes to us out of the folklore. And I use the book The Silver Bullet as the main resource because I kind of had this idea that I do see it over there. Yeah. That's a good, good book.
I've had, you know, after reading your book and I thought, you know, I'm pretty sure I have this Silver Bullet book. I have a lot of books and I'm one of those people that will buy books and then forget to read them. I just keep buying some more. and I thought, oh, I do have the Silver Bullet. So I started reading it. It's fascinating little stories, actually. And you do see some also similarities of different practices of other books that I've read. And so you see the correlation of stories throughout in some parts and others. But really good book. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that was the problem with your questions, because Luzette, when she sees a reference in the book, she has to read them all. So
I do that.
And I actually, when this process started for me, I actually had a lot of different books. And I guess I just had this idea in my head. I was like, well, if I have like 20 books and I'm all about accessibility, And the silver bullet back then was like a $3 book. It's not $3 anymore. It's like up in the hundreds. And I really, really didn't like that.
Is it?
Yeah. I've spoken with the publisher. It's been out of print for a super long time. And you can cut this if you want, but they don't care if you get a PDF online. So you can get it for free. They're not making any money anyway. They haven't made money off this book in 60 years, you know?
Yeah, I can't remember how I got this book. I think I bought it in a charity shop somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I did.
That's kind of the best place to find it. But so I use that as the single reference because I'm thinking this will be easier for people to access when really a lot of those stories are repeated in a ton of other books. And I do cite other books, but I try to keep all the citations of Silver Bullet because I wanted it to be more accessible. Little did I know that, you know, supply and demand, it ended up making it less accessible. So that is one thing that I'm a little sad about. But bringing it back, I am a rambler to the Witch Father. Who is he? How to meet him? I don't think it's possible to specifically meet this spirit unless you live in the regions where I was at the time that I met him. In my personal experience, once you make that lasting connection, he'll come to you. And he will answer that, but he'll also find you more accessible resources. And this is something that happened to me as someone who did move quite a lot and quite frequently, was this experience of being told like, hey, we have a connection that is now going to last forever, basically. I will answer your calls, but you should be connecting to where you are now. And I do, for this particular spirit, really like the term father because there is this paternal care and this almost of like being passed on from the father to who I should be apprenticing under, if that makes sense. And this spirit that has been with me since I was a child, who saw me as a very naive person calling for some ancient dear god and saying, oh man, this kid is going to get himself killed if I'm not there.
I'm trying not to laugh, but it's quite impossible for me.
Witchcraft is funny sometimes, and it's okay to laugh. And I'm a dumb person. I deal with everything in my life through laughter, and sometimes I'm not serious enough for other traditional or folkloric witches. And I just say, like, read the books and see how many times someone casts a spell to make someone shit themselves, because it's really common. Like,
yes, you shouldn't take yourself too seriously. I remember I was working with Eliphas Levi and Elementals, and then I went to the forest and I did all the rituals, and there was a snake like going through my feet, and I got so scared and I was laughing the whole day because I was like, what are you doing? You're totally not prepared to do that. And they're making fun of you. And everything was so funny. Well, the funny part when the snake was not so funny at that point. It's like that because you're asking for it and they give it to you. Always, always.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If you call the spirit, it will always come.
Yeah. But when you speak about the Witch Father in the book, I know that you're speaking about a certain place and a certain experience that is really your own. But I have to be honest with you, you speak about him in such a manner that I'm so sure that if I go to a crossroad, if I follow your instructions, it's so that the energy inside this book is so weird and so powerful that I have to say to you that I'm 100% sure that he's going to come. And in fact, I am going to try that because I tried some stuff of your book, and this is why I liked it so much, because they really work. And it's very difficult to find books that really work. It's just because books are normally books that yours come from a personal experience. So it's something that you found inside yourself. And that's true magic for me. The rest is just, I read that and this, and it was very nice. And I put it all together. Probably I never tried it, but it's fine because other people actually did that and it worked for them. But yours is like something that comes from within, from a place that is not another book. It's your personal experience. So I'll let you know how it goes. And I want to I wanted to
That's the thing is,
everybody's going to want to know how it goes.
If you hear from me again, obviously.
He's like, you know what? I like you a lot. Actually, I'm just going to keep you. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if you call to him, he'll answer. You know, I wouldn't be surprised by that at all. I can't guarantee results. And I think that's what I mean with I can't guarantee that the same entity who guided me through my initiation, which was traumatic and exhilarating and really fucking difficult, will be the same person that answers your call. But it wouldn't shock me too much because he's incredibly capable.
I didn't try it because I'm sure it's going to work. This is why I took my time, because I was like, don't try it if you're not sure about it, because yes, he is capable. Like, it's so weird. I know it sounds weird, but it's there. I'm sure it's there. And speaking about initiation, I wanted to ask you, because you speak about initiation as death. So why?
Initiation by spirit. And I want to really clarify that.
Okay.
Because we have the modern coven system, and even like something like Freemasonry, where there is a ritual play aspect of death. And I don't mean play as in like, haha. I mean like the theatrics of, I don't know how familiar you are with the Masonic initiation, but there is a moment where you're ritually killed and then and carried. My father was a Freemason, so I think it's really boring stuff, but other people think it's awesome. And certain traditional covens have an aspect of the ritual death. In spirit initiation into witchcraft specifically, it is a spiritual death and resurrection. Again, this is where I feel that the kinship again with Christianity so much, because your old life ends, and there's a lot of good. That's scary to say. I'm bringing an end to my old life, and I'm going into something anew. And that happens throughout your entire life. You're initiated constantly, but for witchcraft, this is a one singular instance. And my experience is the one that I can speak on, right? And the ritual that's in the book is really close to what I actually did. There were some personal revelations and personal experiences that I left out because they weren't necessary for like the whole world to read, right? But the actual going through the motions and things like that is what's written in there. And what happened for me was this experience of immense loss, where I really felt myself separating from my past. And this kind of ties back to an earlier statement I said, where I kind of felt like the entity of the Black Woodsman is still with me. I have tattoos dedicated to him on my body. He's still with me. But there really was this kind of, and this initiation was almost part of that, passing me on and saying, I've been with you basically your whole life, and you need to go somewhere else, and I'm here. And there's almost this sensation of like, yeah, he's a big bad devil, but it's hard for me to really see him that way when I feel like I've been taken care of so well. For me, the spiritual death was everything that I had done before in my spiritual practice decayed. That doesn't mean end, right? That means it broke apart. And when something's dead, it fertilizes everything around it and allows you to regrow. It is still painful. And so initiation tore me apart. It sounds very dramatic, but my life really did fall apart at that time. I was very isolated, which is one of the hardest things for me to be. I'm a very extroverted person. I feel like a lot of people in our community are very introverted. I'm the opposite. I'm like, no, I need to talk to someone. I need to be around people. that I was very isolated. I worked a really intense job. I had a lot of physical near-death experiences that I don't know that I attribute to the initiation, because I don't want to kind of go that far off the ledge. But the year after my initial ritual, and I think you can fail your initiation ritual, right? I think you can do it and you can receive no omens. And that should tell you something. That should be the big, like, the spirits are saying, we're taking it easy on you. We're letting you off easy. That's why we didn't show you anything. But by the time I did mine, I had been practicing since I was a kid, and I had gone through a lot of mistakes already. So when it happened, the witch father, and I specifically attribute it to him, the Black Woodsman, he was like, no, you're ready. You asked for it. And I really think initiation by spirit, in my particular case for this tradition, was a, we're not gonna force this on you. You have to ask for it. However, there are other initiations that are not the same as mine. Even in witchcraft, you might experience something incredibly different. An initiation by spirit could be a spirit sickness that knocks you on your ass, brings you to a really scary place, and but only lasts a weekend. For me, it lasted about a year, maybe a little bit longer, a little bit shorter. It was kind of a blur. And it was a really rough time. Other spirit initiations in a different path that I follow was that spirit sickness, was that fever dream of, I don't feel my body, I feel my spirit body. And I feel myself being torn apart by something under the water, right? So I've had two very distinct experiences under two different traditions entirely that had two very different outcomes. One being the witchcraft initiation, which was like, okay, let's see how you handle this year with nothing. All of my spirits stopped answering my calls. There's a saying in the witchcraft community, you should be able to be thrown into a cell naked with nothing but a paper bag and be able to cast whatever spell you need.
I've heard that before, yeah.
And that was my initiation.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally know what you're speaking about. I had this period that everything was empty. I don't know if it's the same thing you're speaking about, but it is like the world was empty. Like there were no devils and there were no angels and there was nothing. Completely, there was no magic. Magic just didn't exist. Nothing existed. And that was so harsh. For me, it lasted more than a year, unfortunately, but probably I didn't need more than a year.
Yeah.
It's amazing that I'm hearing that, really, because I looked in every single book and there was nothing about it, like nothing.
And that's why it's so important to have these conversations, and also so important to, I have this kind of ethos about books, because I get asked all the time, like, oh, when are you going to write your second book? When it's needed. I wrote Southern Cunning not because I'm a super prolific author. This is my first book. I, before this, only ever wrote like academic papers, you know? And this is a huge departure from that because I wanted it to be as accessible as humanly possible, because witchcraft has become very materialistic and really hard to enter into, and gatekeeping in the wrong ways, right? Like putting a paywall, basically, you know, which is why I'm very proud that Southern Cunning is incredibly affordable. The ebook is only a couple bucks. The physical copy is nice and short. It's easy to reread, and it's only about 10 bucks itself. So I'm very proud of that, because I think witchcraft should be accessible in that way. I think we need to be careful about, you know, every magic is witchcraft, but that's a whole different conversation. But I think it's important to have these conversations and write the books that need to be written and not just the books that are going to rake in the cash, because we need to have these real conversations about what it's like to go through these experiences. You know, I took for granted that my spirits were always going to be with me every single minute of the day and that I would have my familiars with me at all times. And then I asked for it and they granted it and they said, no, you don't get to ask familiars for help. your gods will turn their backs on you because you asked for this, and we're going to push you. And I think it was kind of right place, right time, because that was also the period of my life where I needed magic the most. And I had become reliant on my spirit allies and my familiars. And so now it was like, no, this shit needs to come out of me and needs to happen. And on every single step of the way, no matter how hard it was, no matter how demeaning it could be, I got what I needed and what I wanted. And I learned a lot about myself in that time period as well, because I previously had been very much of the idea of, you know, like, oh, magic should be cast for others' benefits, and, you know, you shouldn't sell your services. And during that time, I was like, oh, you think your house is haunted and you need me to come in and do work? Okay, you're going to pay me. It might not be money, but you're going to pay for what I'm doing. I'm not going to just do this for free. I used to do readings for free. During this time, I was like, absolutely not. I learned my worth. I respected myself more, because I was putting in more effort and more work than I ever had before. And I was like, you're not going to get this out of me for nothing. And again, it doesn't always have to be cold, hard cash, but I would at least ask for meals. If I was doing a house cleansing, I'd be like, all right, cook me a meal. You've got it. You know, because food was hard to come by. So I would accept a meal, you know?
Well, actually, once upon a time, it was like that.
Exactly.
You were not supposed to, you were not supposed to ask, but people were supposed to give you something.
Yeah.
So actually, this is absolutely normal. It was like that.
Yeah.
And
going back to the Granny Weatherwax from Terry Pratchett, that's exactly what she would expect. She would expect something in return.
Yeah. So I learned so much about how powerful my craft could be, how powerful I could be, because I couldn't rely on things anymore. And, you know, I stopped putting up with disrespect. Again, I was raised a very particular way. Demure. The adults are talking now. Or one day your boss will be talking and you just listen. Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. And I'm still a very respectful person, but I also now respect myself in turn.
Yeah. And so, that's quite important. Yeah.
It's integral. It's so integral just to be a human being, to learn how to respect yourself. And it took me a long time to do that. And there are some times when it's not like I'm not perfect anymore. There are still times when I undervalue myself and I'm not as respectful to me. But that period of time was a huge push in that. And I learned how to really show people not to disrespect me, and not in a threatening way, but I'm not going to put up with that. And if you are so far gone that you're not going to just give people human dignity, okay, this is the time where I'm going to do the spell when you're going to be removed from my life. And if that means you get fired from your job, well, maybe you shouldn't constantly demean me and threaten me every single day at work, you know? And I stopped feeling bad about things like that. Using witchcraft to better my life when someone else is trying to demean me, I would have felt bad about doing something like that. But at that point, I was like, no, I need to survive, and you're not going to be a bad person and make me feel bad when you get your comeuppance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why witch should never be scared of cursing.
No.
Because cursing and healing come hand in hand.
Absolutely. That ties into, I mean, for me, healing, I don't particularly see myself as an awesome healer as one of my skill sets, but I'm very good at identifying a sickness spirit, and I'm very good at cursing a sickness spirit. And for me, doing healing work is less about, I know amazing Reiki practitioners, for instance, and again, I think sometimes, you know, in the traditional folkloric world, we don't like respect New Age enough. Sometimes there's some New Age nonsense, I'm not gonna lie.
I agree.
Guys, quartz crystals, not just for COVID. Not happening. Just not happening. Wear a mask. But I think Reiki is something that's really, really impressive and does healing in a very, very different way than I do, because my healing is like, okay, what is the animistic manifestation of the thing that's bothering you? Cool. I'm going to go get an iron knife and I'm going to threaten it and scare it out of you. I'm going to trap it in a rock and throw it into a river 20 miles away from you, flowing in the opposite direction, so it can't ever find its way back to you. You know, so I love that cursing and healing are two sides of the same coin, because they are in very literal ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And because there is this particular time of the year, we also wanted to ask you, how do you work with the ancestors?
Ancestor work is so important and hard. For me in particular, I am a white queer American living in the South. Most of my family, most of my ancestors are very racist and homophobic and xenophobic, deeply Christian. And so working with ancestors for me is this kind of interesting bridge between, do you deserve to be in my life? And I think that's a perspective that not many people have in ancestor work. But I think being queer is a huge part of that for me, because in my personal life, in my daily living life, there are family members who don't deserve me. And as a queer person, I have to put that boundary up. As a queer person, I have to say, like, you know, everyone, oh, blood's thicker than water. Not the full quote. The blood of the covenant is thicker than the water of the womb or water of birth. Meaning that the bond with God is more important than your familial bonds. But my interpretation in a different way would be, the bonds that we make with other people, that's family. Queer people, we have chosen family. And in the same way, I have chosen ancestors. There are some ancestors who died more recently. My Mimi, bless her, passed away this last year, and it was really, really hard. And in life, we had a lot of differences. We had a lot of differences. She had a really hard time when I married a man. As in, like, went into and again, Southern families, we're talkers. It's, you know, it's an affair. We are loud and we talk a lot. I told my Mimi that I was getting married on Christmas a couple years ago, and she didn't speak the whole Christmas party, and that was a goddamn miracle.
I know you talk about the ancestors, and yeah, I agree, there are some ancestors that don't, you know, even people that are still alive that don't deserve us. But also working with ancestors, from my perspective, you know, I'm mixed race. I'm half Russian, half Costa Rican, now living in the UK. My ancestors are very, very, very far away, physically, you know, they're like in different lands. And that's how I suppose I feel and I see it. So I'm pretty much creating the ancestors of the land, so working with the land, which is where the important lands for me. But nowadays, in our new sort of communities, we have people that have been moved to other places, you know, they've been located somewhere else, and it's that separation from what you left behind and not being able to connect with that, and you have to make a new connection with what you've got, basically.
I always say that ancestor work is the messiest part of our practice and the most and one of the most foundational. It's hard. It's hard facing these people. Now, I do have some ancestors, and in terms of like ancestral traditions, they all come from Christianity for me, because that's what I was raised with. And if we're talking about ancestral traditions, we should be looking at what we were raised with. So my mother is who I look to for a lot of things in my life. Again, a person I had a lot of differences with, but I now, she did the work, you know? She was deeply homophobic and racist when we were growing up, and my coming out was a horrible thing for her, but she did the work, and she has changed her life so much that we are so close. But a lot of the ancestral practices that I know come from her. We celebrate birthdays. So my pappy passed away almost 20 years ago, and we still light candles for him on his birthday, and we celebrate his birthday. We're not perfect, but they're there. And again, I fought with my Mimi in life, but I knew she loved me, and so she is someone that I treasure. My pappy, I treasure, but there are ancestors who don't deserve me, and that's where we get into the chosen family. So I honor my queer ancestors. Those people that are not related to me by blood, but who paved the way for me to be able to sit here on a public forum and say, I'm a non-binary queer person. My pronouns are they, them. Like, I would have never imagined I could do that growing up. That was not an option. But these ancestors and our modern elders are why we can. And then witchcraft ancestors. Rindy Sue Gross, who is a person who's named in The Silver Bullet. It's a folktale. This is someone who potentially never existed. I consider them an ancestor because the power lies in the story. Humans are storytellers. Our reality is shaped by the stories we tell. So that's an ancestor. Florida, we are starved for witch lore. But we have one witch, maybe. Her name is Elizabeth Budd Graham. She is the Tallahassee witch. Tallahassee is the state capital. And she has this very elaborate grave in the Tallahassee graveyard that faces the opposite direction of sunrise, counter to Christian practices at the time, has this very macabre poem on this huge obelisk, has a large dish in front of it. It's very imposing when you go there compared to all the other kind of plain things. And everyone was like, when she died relatively young, but before she died, she bagged herself a very wealthy man. And so when she died and he was stricken with grief and erected this huge grave to her, everyone's like, she was a witch. She bewitched him.
Money. Of course.
And so this,
you can explain everything with that.
Yeah, not that she was just a lovely person, but no, she had to have bewitched this wealthy man, right? And the story just kept evolving. And so there's nothing from her living time talking about her selling love potions, but after she died, whew, and people started going to her grave and leaving little offerings and leaving notes like, I want Billy to fall in love with me. You know, and so this cultus of Bessie Graham started to evolve locally. And I used to have a website and a blog, and I would go all over the state exploring our folklore and kind of examining it. And when I first heard the story, I was like, this is a cute story. There ain't nothing to it. She's not a witch. There's no evidence she ever practiced witchcraft. And because I have a skeptic's brain, I really do. I know I've spent the last hour talking about talking to stag devils and
but this is exactly what we wanted.
I genuinely do have a skeptic's brain. And so I went there and immediately was like, my opinion doesn't matter. What I think about her doesn't mean anything because her grave was littered with offerings.
And you see, this is witchcraft as well. The thing is that almost everybody practices witchcraft, but then they don't call it this way. I was raised an Orthodox Christian, and Orthodox Christianity is pure witchcraft. It's just witchcraft. Like my grandmother goes to the graves with wine and water, and she puts it on the eyes and on the feet of her loved ones to wash them. And then she gives them wine, and then she gives them food, and then she gives cigarettes. For example, if the person used to smoke, she would give cigarettes to somebody, a stranger, and she would say it's a good omen if they smoke them, because then the diseased one is smoking. That's Christianity. Yeah, right.
Yeah. It's beautiful magic. Beautiful magic. And going to her grave changed my perspective a lot. On, again, the skeptic's brain of like, there needs to be evidence, there needs to be citations, and academic needs to... No, they don't. The belief was so palpable that I formed a relationship there. And I could feel her influence. I'm not going to say her spirit or her intent. Her influence was undeniable. And I could, even just from observing this grave, I could see the little bits of like local tradition that had been woven in. On several different places, I noticed that there would be a twig wrapped in twine. different locations. I can't assume that they were different times, but that's what I'm going to assume. Why not? You know, and so just something that grew out of something probably one person did, another person came there and said, oh, that's probably what I'm supposed to do, and then repeated it. And then another person came, oh, that's probably what I'm supposed to do, and repeat it. And the power of that, she is the Witch Grave of Tallahassee. Elizabeth Graham is the Witch of Florida. Absolutely. And so she is now one of my ancestors. Agnes Sampson, Isabel Gowdy, these are ancestors. So for those of us who feel divorced from our blood ancestors, whatever that really even means, we're not committed to that. I don't have to honor my racist great-great-grandfather or my abusive great-great-grandmother or some ancestor who did horrible things in the past. I don't have to honor them, because sometimes just because you're dead doesn't mean you deserve my respect, because you would have never respected me or my loved ones. But then you get to choose your family. And that's what being queer has taught me, is that you get to choose your family and you get to call to those ancestors who would love to call you their descendant.
That was a nice conversation.
Yeah, I have to say that I knew it's going to be interesting, but then I have like another 11 questions now and I feel desperate. Well, because we were trying to do a podcast that's quite short.
We're failing at that, by the way.
I just couldn't help it.
Yeah, it's just that, yeah, once you get the conversation and going, you can think of so many other things we can talk about. But we really must stop there. I mean, your book is amazing. It's a wonderful perspective from something that you experience, and you can really tell that in the book. Because sometimes you read some other books and it's so obvious that it's just citations or copies of something that they've
so
read
much.
Before.
It was and, a labor of love.
Yeah, your book is, you can see, it's from the heart, it's from your experience, it's from your life. And I think that it's amazing.
Like I said,
and,
I hold myself to this. If I'm called to write something and it's needed in the world, I'll do it.
Thank you so much. It was really, really lovely to meet you.
It was awesome meeting you guys as well. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. So that was Aaron Oberon talking to us about Southern Cunning and his experience in witchcraft and his craft.
Thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you very much. And keep reading.
Keep reading.
We'll never get that at the same time.
No. We're not even trying to.
Exactly. We'll leave it like that.